And you should be live.
Okay, well, good evening, everybody. We're here for the Mountain Regional Water Special Service District Administrative Control Board meeting on November 18th. It's 6:03. We'll call the meeting to order at that time. First on the agenda is any public input. Is anybody on Zoom?
Nope, it's just us and Anna Peacock back at the office.
Okay, so looks like we need to go into executive session for do we have a personnel matter or a legal matter?
I think you have a personnel discussion related to any salary increase for me, the general manager. Mm-hmm. And if you have any legal issues, I don't have any legal issues to discuss.
Okay, is that about right, procedural-wise, Dave?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we need a motion and a second.
Okay, I move that we go into executive session.
It's Karen.
Do we have to say to discuss?
As long as we stated on the recording that it's a personnel matter, it's fine.
Okay, and that's Ian. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, that was unanimous.
So then I'm just going to pause. So I'm going to stop
that one. Yep.
You tried donuts?
We are now back in.
Yeah, I've never had a trouble gaining weight.
Yeah, that was potential.
So we're back in general session here.
Yeah, go for it. I mean, we're
and we're coming out of executive. And coming up on item number three here, consideration of a contract with Jacobs for some work at the treatment plant, the conceptual design. Has everybody had a chance to look at that?
Yep. So, Mike, I need to recuse myself for a potential conflict of interest that I've notified the board of. We've got Joseph Zala from Jacobs.
Can you expand on that just a skosh?
So yeah, sure. Yeah, so we'll have Joseph and Sam are going to lead the discussion this evening. So expanding on it, there's been just some recruitment efforts from the Jacobs organization towards me that I've been a willing participant in. And as a result of that, I don't feel comfortable providing any formal recommendations to the board.
Okay.
Very good.
Thanks for bringing that to the board's attention.
You're welcome. So you can let me know when it's time to come back.
Can I drive? Is,
yeah, it is.
There's no recusal method of the week.
Usually you do.
Oh, okay.
You don't participate at all.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, it's my first time meeting a lot of you guys in person,
yeah.
Which is kind of strange, but nice seeing everybody finally.
Yeah.
A little bit of background on the project, just a broad overview. 2022 is when we're really going to shift gears, focus on expansion of the plant to meet the growing demands of the district. And Scott and I sat down, took a look at projections, our source capacity throughout the district, and the furthest we felt comfortable kicking the project out was to have more production capacity online in 2026. So the whole exercise, we came up with this kind of conceptual schedule that was attached to the board packet and kind of worked back from that date to try and find a design and construction schedule that we thought was feasible.
Sam, is that a change, the 26? Was it out at 28 or something before? Or?
Yeah, I think we had some initial estimates that were 28, 29.
Because with the new hookups that you're showing, we're seeing 3 years of hookups in 1 year this year, which kind of means that the entire schedule's been shifted to the left by about 2 years. So I was wondering if that was something that was planned out there around 28.
We are, I think initially 28, 29 were some days we're kicking around. And we have tried to bake in the most recent acceleration and growth we've seen in the district. It's really challenging, though, to be honest.
Okay.
But that's the broad strokes of the project schedule. So in order to accomplish this whole idea, we're going to try and complete a conceptual or about 10% design, mm-hmm. which I had about with Joseph and Jacob's team. And that's the meat of the proposal that we're recognizing. So the two main goals are the conceptual 10% design of the expansion of the treatment plant. And the secondary goal of the effort is an interim step looking to add redundancy to our current setup. The rationale there being, to meet peak demands, our plant currently runs flat out with no margin for error. A skid can't come offline, and it's an uncomfortable place to be for our ops team, and I think from a planning perspective, it's kind of an uncomfortable place to be also. So we think we found a way we could do that using the existing footprint of the plant, and that's the second piece of the design.
The contract that you have is the amount that's in there is just for 2022. But I think the scope has been written out to the end, including bidding and construction. So what do we have right now as far as projections for the fiscal years out there for budgets on there? Is that something that Jacobs is going to help you with to kind of make some sort of rough estimate of what these next phases are going to be, 30, 60% design?
Yeah, absolutely. Two things on that. And I'll maybe Joseph can chime in too.
Yep.
So, but the bid services that are part of this scope are part of Task 5, which is, again, that interim expansion effort. So we don't mm-hmm. have bid services baked in for the entire plant expansion come online in 2026.
Okay, so it's just for the interim.
Yep. And then the other big piece going on here is we're going to nail down our costs, A, to help with the impact fee analysis on the finance side, and then hopefully those costs can roll in and inform future design fees. Because, Tim, I think where you're going is the following year we're going to double down and go towards the full plant expansion on top of this conceptual.
So right.
We do not have those figures yet for that effort, but that will be part of this 2022 scope, is to help determine what that's going to be. So, Joseph, I don't know.
I would agree. I mean, it's not just part of the 2022 scope is to provide a cost estimate for the expanded facility, but in that, and that's not just construction. That would be the capital expenditure for that facility, which would include permitting, engineering design fees, services during construction, that sort of thing. That kind of makes sense.
And we do that on an annual basis, or do we do it on the project up front and just keep it in the budget and roll it year to year?
So far we've just done the design fees for this, for the 2022 budget. There's nothing formally planned for a 2023 budget, okay. Let's say, yet.
So that's broad strokes on my end, Joseph. I don't know.
If I can ask a quick question.
Sure.
So let's say it's a $15 million facility.
Mm-hmm. Construction.
Construction dollars. What is that usually, not committing you to any number,
sure.
but a percent of that as the engineering fee?
Yeah. So I'm going to start by giving you a wide range.
Okay.
Okay. So I would say, in general, for facilities like this, I'm going to give you a wide range because it really depends on how greenfield, how brownfield your facility is, right? And kind of sometimes even the size of the facility. But generally, as low as 6%, I'm not saying that it'd be that low, 6 to 15, right? Percent of the construction cost. And I would say on average, I mean, it is kind of in the average that you're in the 10% range, 12% range.
Okay.
So for things like facilities and site work, it might be in the 4%.
Exactly.
And when you get into like the process side of it, inside on the thing,
yeah.
It all depends on what you find.
Yeah, and sometimes if you looked at, a brand new greenfield $100 million project, the fees on that might actually tend to be actually lower in a percentage scale than the fees on a, $5 million pump station or something like that, just simply because there's a sunk investment in spooling up and, just some of the work is just kind of you'd have to do regardless whether it's a $5 million project or a $100 million project.
Yeah.
You kind of understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So on the smaller projects, you tend to actually creep up in terms of that percentage
of the project.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The percentage of the project. And on very large projects, you tend to creep on the lower side.
There's some economies of scale.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
So what's a greenfield versus a brownfield?
So greenfield would be blank slate. you're not like really kind of messing with existing structures, tying into existing facilities, that sort of thing. So that would be greenfield, you know, brand new open site. I would call brownfield something where you're tying into existing facilities. You might be, you know, knocking out walls of certain facilities, connecting to them structurally, mechanically, that sort of thing.
And I would just add, we're very much a brownfield site. Because we need to keep our treatment plant completely functional and meeting record production that we've seen throughout this entire period. So we will be on that brown end.
Can I ask one more? I just, since I'm not an engineer, I'm like, I get a little lost when I get in these contracts. So what is GAC, which you was referred to several times in the contract?
Tim had the same comment. That's a great question. So it's granular.
I hate acronyms.
I know.
Oh, you love
them. So. It's
if there's special language, the rest of us don't know what's
I just looked through the whole thing. I'm like, maybe it's going to come up later. No. You know, I couldn't find it.
It's a good comment. Yeah, no, it's granular activated carbon.
Okay.
And we currently have 4 pressure vessels at the end of our treatment process right now that are a polishing step essentially after our membranes, and they're granular activated carbon, which...
So what's meant by additional GAC contractor capacity?
That's one potential outcome of the plant expansion. And that's kind of a lot to digest, but the way we've currently been using our GAC facilities, I think we have long ways to go to optimize those. And one potential outcome of that is adding just additional volume, pushing more water through it, I would say.
Yep.
There's a lot of different ways we could, the road could
Yeah, there's alternatives that don't involve that as well, but involve other things to accomplish the treatment objectives.
Sam, can you talk a little bit about the procurement method that you're using here? Like, generally speaking, on a project of this size, you might go out and seek proposals from numerous firms.
Sure.
I mean, is qualifications-based selection the normal process that the district would use? And what's the situation here? And I don't know, has Dave been informed of it?
Yeah, we have wrote Dave in and gotten some comments from him. And Dave, maybe you can chime in a sec. And we're just talking about the design side, so... The selection of Jacobs.
Well, we're talking about a little bit of the design side, and it's going to turn into a really big design side at some side.
No, that's a good question. So we did a qualifications-based selection. We redid our SOQ process this year. That was the first time I was involved. Myself, Chris Braun, Brian Davenport were on the selection committee. And Jacobs was the only firm selected for our water treatment specialty. And I can talk about the selection process a little bit, if you'd like. But
not a lot. It's just I wanted to just highlight that this is more of a directed contract.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it does stem off our global SOQ process we completed this year. It was a possibility, and we did consider doing a specific SOQ just for this project. And, you know, we tried to reach out, get some board input, and then get Dave's input also, if that was necessary from a legal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But we deemed we were really happy where we were with our selection, how the process played out this past year, and didn't think it was necessary.
Good.
Let me ask some short questions. Have you guys figured in slippage? Not mean deadlines. I mean, if you say this will be done by X date, is it going to be done by X date?
That's a really good question, and I think maybe even more to your point, Joel. We're trying to get a lot of work done in a short amount of time. Joseph, you want to speak to that at all?
Now you're referring to schedule slippage and. And specifically, are you referring to the schedule slippage of what I've understood to be Mountain Regional's goal of having an expanded facility operational and online by your peak demand season of 2026? Is that a fair statement, Sam?
Sure.
Yep. That's what that chart says.
Yeah, that's what that chart says.
And if you don't meet the X date,
right.
Is there... a penalty of any sort whatsoever?
We haven't considered any penalties, I don't think.
That may not be the right word.
No, I follow what you're saying. I would say my main comment on that is when we laid the schedule out and getting feedback from Joseph and the team, I feel like we did try to be conservative both with our design window and our construction window. We basically have 2 years, a two-year construction window, which I'm hoping will be adequate and provide a little bit of buffer to hopefully mitigate any slippage, as you put it,
yeah,
that we might see. And the same thing on the design side, where we have about a two-year design window.
Okay. And then to follow up with that, I know we've all heard a lot about supply chain, and I mean, have you guys thought this thing? Have you thought this through as well? I mean, what if we can't get certain parts? I mean, what are we going to do about that?
Yeah, I haven't drilled down that kind of detail on the full expansion effort, but that's certainly something we need to keep in the back of our heads for sure.
That's a good comment. If you say X date, I'm concerned that we're not going to meet X date for whatever reason. I don't care if it's slippage. I don't care if it's supply chain. It may cost some more money as well.
Sure.
And that'll get really key probably as we start to go out to bid for the actual construction part of the project, is when we'll really have to be putting some hard timelines. Can we get this done now? Once we get the design done, know what, because at this point, so I'm not to, but we don't even know what we're going to build yet.
Everything's
in the air. No, I understand that. Yeah. So, I understand that. But, I mean, what I'm trying to say is, we should review this to make sure at the end of the day about our issues in terms of slippage, which will include everything.
Sure.
I mean, I don't want to have a discussion that we haven't thought of this. I think it's really important, really, really important, because we don't know when this freaking supply chain is going to be fixed or not.
Well, Sam, does your general contract have liquidated damages clauses in there that are enforceable for the contractor, where you cite that the district actually has a hard cost if it's not done by that date? It could be the extension of inspection staff.
Sure.
A contract that you can't supply.
Yeah, so typically in our design bid build projects, we keep liquidated damages language in the contract to try and ensure schedule and project delivery. But again, we're so early on, we haven't even decided on a project delivery route. So even that's kind of up in there. But that's certainly one avenue I think we need to consider depending on how we decide to go about the construction process.
And Joel, sometimes if you have these contracts where they have schedule penalties, you'll get a longer schedule to start with.
Oh, I know.
they're not dumb on their end either.
I didn't want to say that. But, I mean, the contract is one thing. The length of the contract is another thing. And slippage is another thing. And to paraphrase, I mean, penalties or not meeting schedules are very, very important. Not just to get the project done, but from a cost standpoint, I think we should all be concerned with that.
I think another thing we could do periodically, I don't know what a good interval would be, but provide schedule updates and kind of look at workload and you know, get board input. I think that'd be useful.
Yeah. It'd
be useful for me to get that feedback, so I think we could certainly try
that. Hopefully making sense.
Yeah. Quarterly.
Yeah, quarterly sounds.
Maybe if it's available.
Yeah, especially project of the size of the district. That seems.
This
more
project definitely falls within the percentage of money that it will be on the list of things we have to update, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how we set up that threshold last time of we'll only review projects over a certain amount, this will definitely be at the top of that list for several years.
Well, the scope looked reasonable and the price looked reasonable to me. I mean, the schedule. A lot of times it has to do with how much the district can contribute in these meetings. Don't change your mind.
So if there's no other questions, are we ready for a motion? Right, because we need
yes.
Make a motion that we approve the contract for the, I guess it's the expansion
Sam, maybe
of the water treatment facility
agenda.
Signal.
Okay.
To the first tab.
And that would be awarding it to Jacobs, right?
Yes.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay, yeah. So that was unanimous.
That usually gives them the language.
Having you guys get started with that.
Or to me as well.
Great. Does someone need to sign?
Michael will sign.
Okay.
But I don't think we have a Jacob signature yet, right?
We're working on getting one. Should we sign it first?
Usually we have them sign it.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll sign it first and kick it over.
Okay.
And we'll provide it to Michael. Okay, appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay.
Nice to meet you, Sam.
Yeah, likewise.
Okay, we have item four is our consent agenda. We've got the minutes, the check register, a couple of purchase orders tonight. Were there any questions or comments on the minutes?
No.
No. How about the check register?
No comments on the check register. I know. I even went back through and I was like, there's got to be something.
Come on, we can't see Bill White without asking, at least drilling them on a couple.
I got some quick ones.
Okay.
It was just, I got kind of thrown off by this at first because I thought Iron Mountain, I thought it's like this data collection place, right? And I was thinking, what are you paying them so much? But was that known that you were going to be paying them $80,000 back?
What that is that?
And Iron Mountain's up there by.
It's the
colony or something.
It's the colony developer. So much like Promontory,
right.
Where we reimburse after they.
That was $644,000 that went back to
Promontory,
right.
And about $80,000 to Colony or IMA.
And what's the GIS thing that goes? That's getting paid to the sewer district. Is that something that we do annually? It looked like it was a renewal for the 2022 where we paid the sewer district $2,000 to do some joint GIS stuff.
What it is there is local organizations contribute to a pool to run a flight, basically, to map, get aerial imagery for all of, I'll just say the Centerville Basin. And
so it's mapping... Aerial mapping, not so much GIS.
Correct. It's our contribution to the aerial mapping, which turns into imagery files that we use in GIS.
Okay. There were some drug screens. Was that routine?
Yeah.
Or random?
Routine, random dot drug screens for drivers.
Okay. That's it.
Okay. Yeah, I always forget about those reimbursements.
Yeah.
So how does that work? They paid him ahead of time, and then when we...
Scott and I had this conversation today.
Let me see if I can...
So when Promontory first was building their infrastructure, the county issued a bond so that the money... Promontory would have the money to build the infrastructure. It worked out to be that about a little over $5,000 per lot is what that we would have to collect to pay back the bond. So every time Promontory sells a lot to a customer, part of the title closing is we get a little more than $5,000. Then when that customer comes in, they pay an impact fee like all of our other, similar to all our other customers. But since they've already paid for the bond or for the infrastructure, we only keep the portion that
when
isn't related.
When they closed. That's
correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So when Promontory sells the lot, we get money to pay the bond.
Right.
The bond basically paid for most of their impact fee or their infrastructure. There's a little piece. When the person who's now purchased the lot goes, wants to build their house, get their building permit, they have to come in and pay an impact fee.
Right.
But since we've basically already been paid through the bond for the infrastructure, we give most of that back and keep a percentage that's calculated in our impact fee to cover the stuff that is not in the bond. Sorry, it's kind of complicated.
So when Promontory sells a property, Is it a fixed amount?
Yeah.
$5,000?
$5,214.
But some of these impact, is the impact fee fixed? Is it a...
It's also fixed for Promontory based on, there's two, depending on when they kind of became part of the bond or the lot and how much we needed back.
So how did we, if it's $5,000, we would have had to have had 100 to get to $500,000. We'd have to sell 100 properties.
Yeah. And that's...
And the amount used to be higher. I mean, you know...
So they've had 100 properties and...
They've sold 110 this year.
Yeah.
But that's not the 5,000. When their customers come... This is from when they come pay their impact fee. That's about $16,000. We give them basically $14,500 back. We keep rounding. I'm doing some rounding, obviously. About $1,500. So the 600 there, you really would have to divide that by about 14,000 to figure out how many lots were sold during that time frame. So it's not 100 because it's more of a divided by 14,000, not 5,000. The 5,000 doesn't show up on anywhere. That's just revenue we get.
And the sister gets to keep that money until the buyer pulls a permit. So there are lots that will never be built on, and yeah. You know, the district will just keep that money forever and ever.
Interesting. Okay. So any other questions on the check register? Nope. Okay. Looks like we had a purchase order.
It was in your packet. We've got one for Electro Power of Utah. This is the Kilby Road electrical upgrade. Mm-hmm. This is the new MCC assembly that they're going to put above ground out of the water.
What does MCC stand for?
Please,
for say it again. I missed it.
MCC.
The contractors?
No, that's what it's called. An MCC assembly.
Motor Control Center, Motor Control Cabinet.
Okay. Where are my engineers when I need them? Come on.
We're called two different things.
So it's where the wires come into from the utility.
It's the electrical
and go out to the pumps.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a big panel, and this has about a 3 or 4 month lead time right now, so we won't even be able to install this until late spring, probably, or have it installed until late spring.
Does this fit our procurement regs as far as did we need for this amount? Did we need three bids or?
We do a sole source with ElectroPower because they do all of these, because to have them be able to communicate and do the same functionality and merge with the SCADA system. So I think I included in the packet, for any procurement, we also fill out if we got multiple bids, if it was a sole source, on the back. So, and that's where Scott and I both have to sign it. We write the explanation of why we believe it's a sole source.
Very good. So, any questions on the consent agenda items?
Sure.
Okay, do we have a motion?
I move to approve the consent agenda.
Okay, thank you. And a second?
Second.
Joel, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So that was unanimous. Can I just sign this right now?
Yeah, that's the purchase order. And with wet signatures.
Day
on there, 18, sure, it doesn't require one, but
okay.
And that's the check register when you get at the back.
Okay. So, moving on to the back page here, financial management. A little bit of an update on the budget in the October.
So there was a little memo, Scott. Maybe you could just bring
up.
First of all, the presentation went really well, I think, to the county. I think they appreciate our preparation and things like that. So there were no comments to it at that point. Once we got back, we did find out from the county that for the health insurance, they are increasing the amount of contribution we can make to the HSA. So for a family or two party, it went from $2,500 to $3,000 on the high deductible plan, which is really nice for employees because basically it's almost a zero deductible plan for them.
Yeah.
And for the single parties, it goes from $1,250 to $1,500, kind of the same thing for them. They have a zero deductible plan now. So that added $7,800 of net cost to our budget for next year, so minimal. But it does end up rolling through because it is an expense, several slides. And then the other thing is October water sales were a little bit, were lower than we'd hoped or planned. And so just to be on the safe side, I took that amendment that we had at 50,000 to 80,000 just to make sure we'll cover that. Of course, that's covered with other revenue, so it's no, still a net zero. It just is alerting them to the fact that retail water sales might be a little lower than we've even projected before.
So I didn't understand that because it's a shortfall.
Yeah.
And so we didn't come in as much, but it seemed like the 80 should have grown and not gotten smaller.
Well, it went from 50 to 80. So we predicted a $50,000 shortfall, okay, and now it's an $80,000 shortfall.
Okay. That helps. Thank you.
Good.
So that's where we're at. Somehow I've got a ton of other revenue from other places, though. I don't know. So.
It's great when that works out.
Okay.
So those are the only changes we're going to take to the December 1st, potentially December 8th, back to the council. Hopefully they'll just, basically I'll give this kind of same point to them, and I think we'll be good to go.
Will you keep us posted on whether, like, I assume we're going to go to that, we'll be at that meeting, or is it not necessary?
I don't think it's necessary.
I wouldn't worry about it. I don't know.
Dave, do we need a motion to accept this recommendation?
That's a good question. Lisa and I had talked about that, Dave. So since there's a couple changes in, you know, we had a proposed, you know, recommendation for the council to approve Mountain Regional's proposed budget in for the last council meeting in November, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's been a couple changes to that. Do we need a formal motion again to have recommendation of that proposed budget with these changes to go to council in December?
I would.
Okay. If they were suggestions, yes. If it was a directive, probably no.
Okay. So I think that makes sense.
Were they suggestions?
They weren't suggestions from the county.
Well, we're...
So let's have the board do a formal motion.
Yeah.
Do I have a recommendation to present to the, we're recommending to the county council to accept the revisions.
The budget with the
changes as shown in the memo.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So I make that motion.
That's Karen. And Joel, thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
That was unanimous again. So thank you for doing that. Then October, what do we do?
October, we continue. I just will hit repeat. I'm playing this for you guys. But the one thing is we have made up a little more ground, let's say, on expenses. So we're about $500,000 under budget on expenses right now. That's the $502,000 you see there. Our revenue, we're about 3.8 over, so we're about 4.3 better than budget. So basically, we expected to be at 2.9 million in net position or net income. We're at 7.4 because of all the impact fees. So the revenue, as I've continued to highlight, the big variance is obviously the development-related collections. If we took development-related collections out or had them at budget, we would be $368,000 better than budget. So we'd be really tight to budget, in other words, if it wasn't for the impact fee.
Does that affect our days in reserve or whatever it is if we did that?
It
seemed like it leaked a lot this last month.
It's leaked more because of the impact fees go into their own reserve. So that doesn't impact our days on hand. What does is the meter connection fees, that $1,800, $2,400 that they pay each time they come in. So that's where a lot of that has jumped. We've had the regional supply revenue come in. So that's really caused a lot of the jump in the days. Also, a lot of our capital expenditures are coming right now. Some big invoices from Jacobs, a big invoice from Newman for the Kilby Road line. You'll see in next month's check register. And we'll be paying $1.8 million to Weber Basin in December, too. So our cash it always kind of hits a high point about right now. We've had all our summer collections, and now we start to go the other way for a while.
So what's included in a day? I mean, is it like salaries and depreciation,
yeah,
but not
what it
is itself, or what?
Yeah, so we take our cash budget, for example, for next year is about $8.7 million. So cash on hand is, that's it for the year, is our 8.6. So how much of that, if we have $8.6 million in reserve, we'd have 365 days.
But is it like saying it's your overhead, a day of overhead?
Yeah, well, it would be one way to describe it. That basically, if revenue stopped flowing at all, how long could we actually pay our bills?
It's all expenses, right? So it's not just overhead. It's, you know, it's maintenance expenses. It's things like that.
It's our daily
payment
burn.
Our daily burn.
Okay.
Depending on how, you've heard it before.
But, all right.
We can keep going down a little bit, I think. Operating expenses. So the savings, mainly through operations, maintenance, and repairs. They obviously have the higher budget. We had to have some savings in kind of our admin costs. So that's where the $502,000 in savings comes from. The cash position, which you were mentioning, Tim.
Keep going, Steve?
Yeah, go ahead and keep going. Is quite high. We're at 449 days. Even last year, you can see we're at 388 days. So this is kind of a high point always for us in the year.
Do you think that we need to... are we going to set up our drought fund or, I guess it would be nice to have that.
That's my question.
This is showing we could run the district for a year for no.
The council approved that, and we'll set up our drought fund. We'll pay out. Lisa and I were actually going through this so that, we could go through $3 or $4 million pretty easy here real fast and bring that number way down.
Yeah.
The other thing is...
And we're also, the money that we have in there now, right? You have all that money, but that's how we're spending for our capital outlay for next year.
Yeah.
So the Summit Park tank, these engineering design fees, that all we have now from what we've been able to record will now be paid out next year. So it's a little bit false to think that we are definitely going to spend it. And as we're looking at, where some of we're going to have some costs headed our way.
So there's liability against that, known.
Oh,
yeah.
We have an office building that we're looking at building, and we have a treatment plant that we're looking at bringing online. So I'm glad that we have it. We also have uncertainty with drought right now. I don't know if we're going to get enough snow to fill up the reservoirs this year, but we're adequately reserved to help weather that storm right now with the cash position that we're in. So I think it's not going to sit there for too much longer.
Hey, the soil's moist now.
Yeah.
That's what I said. Well, you can't have it either way. I mean, you either have some moist soil and no snow, or low moisture and snow. I don't know.
You can just combine those in the same year. That'd be really nice.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So something.
Our happy cash days will come to an end, unfortunately, in the future.
Well, let's talk about that just a second. Let's say that we spend all this money, and we obviously we don't want to. But what are we doing to protect ourselves? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Part of it is we do set up a lot of reserve, or we call them rate stabilization funds too, that we only can tap into if something doesn't go as planned. Because we always have to be able to generate enough to pay our bonds, and that's kind of part of the budget we talked about last week.
That's the drought reserve fund.
We've got several funds, right? We've also got the rate
stabilization
fund,
a treatment plant fund, a Lost Canyon fund, so we can keep maintenance up even if revenue starts to shortfall.
Yeah.
So for a year, let's say we could only use revenue to really cover hard or variable expenses, we at least have some other cash to pay some other things.
But we'll also be doing not only an impact fee study this year, but we'll also be doing a rate study. So that rate study will take into account, these things that we're talking about expense-wise, because there is going to come a time that we're going to have to do a rate increase.
Okay, and
that's how we manage that.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's any other questions for Steve?
Any questions on water consumption or connections?
Yeah. Okay.
Steve, you wanted to just touch
on this. I was going to hit this real quickly. As you can see, so the low point there in August, that was the impact of conservation and the rainy August.
With the purple line.
The purple line, you can see historically, we did feel, I mean, that was a good significant drop. We kind of went back to more of a normal September, more of a normal October, because as we get into the tail ends of the bell, let's say, it's more base. It's more predictable. We're not as, usage doesn't play such a big swing on usage or on revenue, sorry. The interesting thing is right now we're making about $20,000 more in base than we were at the beginning of the year because of the customers we've added. So when you look at the August, how much it had dropped, you figure if we hadn't added that base, it would have even dropped a little bit more, let's say. So
well, just looking at starting in August of last year is when you started, you probably should have started seeing that generation of additional revenue at that point. Because look at the gap there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just saying that's what the sales is, and I know that.
Yeah.
It's just relative to where it was last year. If you say last year was a good year, yeah, and this year's less than average.
I almost like to look at also the, like, let's look at April of on the graph. You'll see how all the other dots are kind of very similar, mm-hmm, but the purple dot is higher. Basically, the difference is base because usage is very low in April, no matter how, you know, and so that's where you can kind of see how much base meant.
But you're still looking at that gap, that area between those two curves.
Yeah.
Starting back in August.
Yeah, starting in August. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, so that's, I think that's it for me. There was a, by category, where you can see golf shut off a little earlier, a lot of irrigation shut off a little earlier, and residential shut off earlier. So we
anything unexpected on that?
Well, just that, wow, you did. Everybody did shut off earlier because kind of habits, and it started to freeze and rain. And last October, you remember, was kind of dry, and everybody could leave their irrigation systems on longer, so, or did.
So we had, not the shortfall that the, that's one of
the shortfall in October. Yeah, so we amended the budget a little bit more.
Okay.
That's good.
All
right, thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
Are we digging deep enough to anticipate growth on the new with the new developments and unopened plots that may be sold? What I'm trying to say is, are we anticipating any growth based upon those numbers?
So it's a good question. So I regularly update our growth projections. Obviously, this year is far and away larger than, you know, probably any other year for the district if we don't consider annexations, right? So as we look to the future, I need to start to prepare Weber Basin's sort of 5 and 10 year forecast for water demands. And, you know, some of the surpluses that I expected to have in years 6, 7, 8 out there that we intended to put to make available through the master agreement to Summit Water, we'll need to reconsider that, whether or not that water is available, you know, because if the growth rates continue at the rate that they're doing today, then, you know, Sam and I have some work to do on building some redundancy into the system with the sources that we have. And then secondly, we'll be very focused on this treatment plant expansion to make sure that stays on schedule to come online when it needs to. But you know,
it's really tricky.
Yeah.
And one thing that helped me when I think about it is that our district is bound, and so that's all we have to think about right now.
Yeah.
And then it's just a matter of the timing of that, and then that's what you're looking at is, well, how fast are we, is the future coming?
Yes, exactly.
But to anticipate growth outside the district is is really difficult.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, you did.
Okay.
My point being is, I was driving Heber today. Let me just finish. And the growth is unbelievable over there. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And there's new developments there. There's new one-bedroom apartments there. Yeah. There's, I mean, there's a part of the language. Yeah. There's a shitload of stuff over there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have two choices here in our area in Park City. That is to go up or to go out, or a combination of the two.
Yeah.
And I'm really, really concerned about, and I've talked to you about this, I'm really concerned about water in general.
Yeah.
I mean, there may come a time where we may say, whoa, we can't do this development because there's no water.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just want to make sure.
Well, he has a chart that shows that with his growth and our water resources.
Right.
Oakley said, well,
that, to kind of compartmentalize that and focus that into a single kind of thought is that would happen if we outpace the master agreement's ability to make more water available. Right, master agreement is this agreement with Weber Basin and others, right? And so, if growth outpaces, it's a 5-year contractual period. So, if we say in 2026, or let's say in 2026, we said we would need additional water, which is not what we're going to say, but just hypothetically speaking, if growth accelerated beyond our forecasts, and we started to see that we would need water earlier, then we would have to put a halt on connections in the district.
Concurrency wouldn't let you sign those will serves.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we just got to get to all the way to the book. I'm sorry. That's good.
It's a good question.
He was asked a very similar question last month at the budget hearing with the county, which he gave a very articulate answer to. About growth and our role in it. So,
I mean,
yeah,
the
sorry.
Planning Commission. I mean, we're looking at some really big developments as possibilities, and I'm really concerned about water.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of my decision-making process.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I can tell you that the two large projects that we're either anticipating or experiencing, we were preparing for.
Okay.
So anything, we haven't been caught off guard by any one project. I would just say that the growth in general this year across the entire district has been growing at a faster rate. You know, homes are being built at a faster rate than what we anticipated and faster than what we typically experience.
Yeah.
Scott, what about annexing other water companies? We don't know when it's going to happen or if it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And if they're private, they're not necessarily transparent at this point about what their inner workings are. But if they fail, we got to take them on. Now, is that a potential? Is that just a black swan where we just don't know?
I'll use the one that we're working through right now. We're hiring a third-party engineering consultant to review their system, and whatever shortfall they have, whether it's in source or infrastructure or anything else, that will need to be remedied by those specific customers. We'll borrow money to remedy their deficiencies. And those specific customers will pay an assessment. So I think as long as we do a good job of doing our homework through annexations and follow a good process, I think it limits our risk.
Okay. I think that gets us there on that one.
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you for that presentation, that part. So, Anna, we're ready for you to take over here. It sounds like on item 6 of the meters?
Yes. So what we would like to do is we're coming to the end of our meter replacement program. We have about 25 there's one to replace throughout the district. They are all indoor mirrors, so either in the office, in the building, somewhere where they have to give us access. It just seems to be hard to get them to respond to our letters, emails, phone calls. So we'd like to give them a hard deadline.
Okay.
And then if we don't hear from them, we would like to give them a average billing instead of going out physically and manually using their meters. Because it's a lot of time for our operators to do that. So that would make it easier as far as billing, would be 25 people. And then if they still don't respond to our request by March, we would like to install meter pits outside at the cost to the homeowner.
Okay. So how does this fit with our rules and bylaws?
So there's a specific provision here in the rules and regs that Lisa put in the memo that talks to that. That basically, if our access to the meter is obstructed, that the district, the district will relocate the meter and charge the cost back to the customer. There in the middle of that paragraph. And we're dealing with not only operational, the addition of man hours, right? Of people having to manually perform this read process. We're also, my understanding, I think, dealing with obsolescence issues with software related to the old meters. So we're going to get to the point where we can't even read these meters. And we believe it's justified. We wanted to share our plan with the board because we've run into some resistance in the past related to an issue similar to this.
Yeah.
And we just wanted the board to understand what the plan was, and if you have any concerns, now's the time to let us know.
So, Anna, how many meters have we changed out to date? Like 2,000?
Throughout the district?
5,000.
We currently have 4,330.
So out of 4,000 meters, we had a few, that makes sense. And so this seems like a reasonable approach to get into the last hard ones.
Yeah.
And does anybody else?
Yeah, I'm 100% behind this. I mean, if you've been trying, you're just going to have to...
I'm more interested in the mechanics of this. I mean, is there a... does their next bill come with like a time and material surcharge on it, and if they don't pay it, then it goes to someone to do collections, or is it just a lien against the
property? It'd be a lien just like any other unpaid bill that the customer would have.
I think that you're keeping their water running and you're having to deal with what you got to deal with. I suggest that you probably set something up where each one of those individual sites are time and materials instead of just a flat amount.
That's what we would do. We tried to provide some benchmarks to give the board an idea of what it might cost the customer, but yeah, it's a time and material
basis.
Is
it going to be done within the paved right of way or within the roadway right of way?
Not within the paved right of way, within the roadway right of way. Typically, where the meters
in Silver Springs, there's about 15 feet from the back of the curb to where the right of way is.
Yep. Yep.
And you're not supposed to build any structures there.
Yep.
But people have all kinds of stuff, including trees or whatever, because there's a good chance that you might have roots on a tree around the thing in that area. Have you decided whether you're going to replace or?
Yeah, so
it's not going to be all that clean.
It's
right?
Not going to be all that clean. That's a good point, Tim. And we've run into this in the past, and we're certainly going to run into it. If we're hoping that by
becoming
you're pick
more.
Up 13.
What's that?
You're going to pick up 13, and there's still going to be 12.
Yeah, I mean, we're hoping we're going to pick some up as part of this process, as part of this communication process. There's going to be some we probably won't, and those could be messy. And, you know, Brian certainly knows from his experience, you know, some of these can be in really tough situations. They can be in very expensive landscaping. If that's the case, we hope the customer will be motivated to let us into their home to replace their existing meter.
Is the bottom line that we're going to get more efficient and we're going to do a better job of measuring water usage?
Yeah, I mean, the old meters are at the end of their useful life. So there's you know, I think there's an expectation internally that we're replacing an old meter whose accuracy might be suspect with one that is more accurate. And the new meters offer, you know, the what the access tools, the application, right? There's a lot of
remote read.
Yeah, there's a lot of really great features of these new.
I mean, are we putting that out to people so they know that there are positives, pros and cons?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We've tried to contact these people. Emails. Jackie and Anna have sat there and called. I mean, they just won't respond. So, and we've done lots of proactive, and like, you know, of 4,300 customers, we have 25 left. So the majority, everybody was on board and wanted to do it. It's just these last few holdouts, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Anna, but this has happened before with the last time there was a meter replacement. There were a final few holdouts that we needed to do meter pits for. So it's going to happen. But this is just the process we want to use.
Out there, I mean, how surgical is that? Because they're not marked.
No, they have to go out and do blue stakes. And
right,
I guess.
But, I mean, they could end up digging a 15 foot wide hole to find a 3/4 inch pipe.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Well, I think we support this.
Yes.
Or taking down a 15 foot tree.
Yeah.
We'll keep you updated.
I think it's a good plan and good luck.
Thanks.
It's all you can do, really.
I mean,
is there any other options? I mean, have you thought through it? I mean, this is it's consistent with the language.
The only other option is just to continue average billing, which I don't think is fair to the other customers, because we don't have we won't have any ability to know how much water they're using.
And they've had 4 years.
So we're headed here to item 7.
Yep. I just have a couple quick items. The fraud risk assessment. You saw this last year. This was the state auditor's new requirement that came out in 2020. The fraud risk assessment is meant to be done annually. There were no changes from the prior year. So I've included the schedule that we went through to recognize those internal controls that we have, and the two new controls which we added this year, which was the fraud reporting and the fraud hotline we added to our policies. So the final two boxes that we can't check is the internal audit function and a formal audit committee, which we've determined at this time, due to the size of our organization, it just doesn't really make sense to have a formal internal audit function for the size of the district. And as an audit committee, we have a finance committee, which is the entire board, and we bring our budgets and audits to you. So we feel like that's adequate. So that still keeps us at the very top end of the low level based on the points earned of 355. So for the size of our district, we have adequate, I think, controls in place right now to support the functions of the district. And we've already submitted this assessment to the state auditor last year. We did not receive any comments. So this will go to the state auditor again. And it'll just be an annual process. If they decide to change the form of it or change questions, we'll continue to review that.
Which were the two that we took action on?
We put a fraud hotline in, and we did a reporting process for fraud, whether internal fraud reporting, either from internally or externally.
So that came out last year, and then, mm-hmm. and then we've responded and... Mm-hmm. And it's reflected here. And
yep.
What was our score last time?
Last year we were at...
I'm
roughly 350.
330, and now we're at 355.
Yeah. When do you think we're going to have the internal audit come into your function?
I think we would have to be fairly large. You know, 26 employees right now. We're a pretty small finance department of two. So to have a formal internal audit function, I don't think is warranted at this point. Maybe if we hired another person, we talked about, you know, as a, you know, maybe if we hired another person, we could maybe leverage off another entity to help come in and do some internal control testing, because we do still have our internal control testing done by our outside auditor. This would just be in addition to that. But an internal audit function at this size of an organization doesn't really make sense.
But what this is saying is if you get a certain score, that you're okay on fraud.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That you're at least as protected as you can.
We've chosen to take two that are worth 20, which whoever's put this sheet together thinks that these are really critical ones, and we've offset them by a bunch of fives that are things like ethical behavior, whatever that means, that's worth five. And if you gather four of those together, it's equal to one of these 20s down there. So I'm saying that we're getting these fives pretty easily. But in net, we're saying we're okay because we got this passing score. So I think you maybe want to take a look at that and say, should we at least do this every other year? Or is there other agencies that also think they're small? And there's a roving auditor that goes around and does it, because we certainly have the money to do it. So it just seems
that's
to
definitely
be like,
for a discussion. If you, I think I wrote in here last time or this, you know, before, we could ask, you know, hire an outside party to come in and do just some internal control testing.
We're just taking a look at this overall score, and we're saying if we get this score, we're doing something against fraud, but we're leaving two critical parts out of.
But I think the others are very critical. I mean, I think those are just the two. You know, I don't think we could get 100% for the size of the organization that we are.
Look at number two. It's do you have something in place that addresses these things? Yeah. Right.
Yes, but look at number one is 200 points. So that's actually the largest one, and those are basic separation of duties. And I think we're doing a lot of that really well for the size of the organization that we have.
But why do you think they're asking for an internal audit at all?
Because it's a recommended control. I think a lot of, you know, entities have internal audit functions in place. Larger organizations have internal audits. It's a good control, but are the resources adequately being used appropriately for the size of our district? And do you think there's fraud within the organization? If you think there's the management team maybe you're not comfortable with, or you feel like there are some things we need to do improve upon, then that's up to the board. If you'd like to, we can certainly form an internal audit function and we could designate resources to it. It's going to be over $100,000 to hire somebody.
Well, the score aside on this, don't we think it's a good idea that if we do it like maybe at least once and see if there's anything that's changed over the years relative to that initial?
Well, we did switch auditors, so we had
an external
auditor.
This is asking for internal audit.
This is internal. So this is not only our external audit that we have reviewed, our internal controls annually, which we do change. We, you know, go to change at a minimum of every 7 years. We just changed 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we had an external auditor reviewing our controls. We never had any findings. We had a new auditor come in, review our controls, no findings. So if you think that we're going to mitigate some type of risk because we're not getting 20 points and we want to put some money towards it, that's completely up to you to decide if that's how you'd like to spend the ratepayers' money. District staff is just saying that we don't think at this level and with the other separation of duties, the oversight of the county, the tying of our policies to really, the county's looking at our policies as well, and the council has oversight. We don't think there's really an area for risk. But if you want to do that.
Could the county audit be considered an internal one, or is that external?
It'd be an external one, but I think, I mean, what you could do is, you could certainly form an audit committee, have an audit, two members of the board, and your task may be when the external statutory audit's done, you have a sit-down discussion with the external auditor.
You address that in your memo where you're saying that we do have a finance committee or something.
And we do bring the auditor in, and she speaks to all of you. You could have just a subcommittee and have it just be two people and then go through that.
But my point on this is
back to the full board.
It isn't trying to. It's not trying to make life difficult over at the district or anything. I'm just pointing out that we shouldn't take a look at this as just a pure scorecard type of thing and say we're above this minimum without taking a look at what whether these functions are important, whether
value.
Is it scalable? Apparently, you're saying it's not scalable between a 200 person firm and a 26 person firm.
There is
a function that somebody else put on this paper here that says it's more important than not the 200 up at the top.
And this is kind of something new from the state to have us start to fill out. I think they're still kind of learning the process. I think with the next year's audit, I think it'd be excellent to have Dana come up. And, I mean, you've seen the numbers usually, but have her spend some time on our internal controls and if she thinks there is risk and where we might be able to mitigate that. And maybe she can even expand on what she's seen as internal audits, an audit committee. I think having care and review, maybe
you'd have to come up with an internal audit program. And I agree with you, Lisa, that, you know, having the appropriate separations of duties and having these other policies in place, you know, I mean, all those kind of, they mitigate your risk, you know, by not having the person that's receiving checks making adjustments to somebody's account. All those things, you know, are reducing the risk of the district. And, you know, so you have to weigh whether you would find $100,000 worth of waste, you know, in order to pay for that person. Or, you know, and larger districts may be able to afford that and may have more turnover or something that...
So
I can think about
what... The question is, do you believe that not having the internal audit ever done or ever having the audit committee is okay?
I think a lot depends upon what you expect out of.
Okay, maybe we should table this and come back to it. But it feels like we're kind of going down.
Well, this is just—if you don't need to take an action on it, this is the state auditor has just asked that we present the audit assessment to the board. If you'd like us to postpone it, we've presented it. That's our requirement for the year. If you'd like to discuss further forming an internal audit function and an audit committee, we can postpone that to another meeting.
Let me ask one question. Is there anything on this list that concerns you guys?
Nope.
No.
From my perspective, the scorecard at the top, I don't know if that's arbitrary or not. I'd want to know, are we following the best management practices based on our external auditor? Is she comfortable with what we're doing? Do we have controls in place?
Yes, because we would receive audit findings.
Yeah, and if that answer is yes, then I'm comfortable with it.
This is by the state, and it kind of helps us along. Right, it helps us find places where...
Areas of improvement.
All right.
I think it comes out of... I can tell you how it came about.
But really quickly.
Really quickly. It came because the State Board of Education decided to stand up an internal audit function and use that internal audit function to do a risk assessment of the entire public education system, and was able to find so many things wrong and to change them. The legislature liked that and decided everybody should have one. That's why you have it in the statute.
To do this risk assessment.
To have an internal risk assessment and an internal audit committee. That's the reason why, and that's why I said, it depends upon what you want to accomplish with an internal auditor. And there is a recognition that, you know, the smaller you get as an entity, maybe you don't need all those things. I mean, if you wanted to check off on your checklist an audit committee, you could have your finance committee double it double that and check off 20 points. I don't know that it would give you anything more than what you're getting now, because you meet with your external auditor. But to the extent that you wanted to expand the audit function, so for example, there were some concerns during this year about security, and in terms of, I mean, there was a hacking and those kinds of things. One of the things internal auditors might do is they may label certain things to be a higher risk and do an audit and come back to you and make recommendations with regard to how to protect yourself against, you know, cybersecurity threats. They can do things like that. So, but it depends upon what you expect your internal auditor to do. You don't have to hire somebody to be an employee. You can do it on a contract basis. There are firms that have both, both performance auditors as well as financial auditors. You can find those companies that do those. You don't have to do it every year. You could do it every other year.
That's kind of like what we do with the auditor anyways, isn't it?
Well, he comes in every year.
It would be outside of that. If you had a scope of work, or like Karen said, a program, an audit program that you wanted to put together and circle through, you know, different cycles, you could do that.
Well, understanding what the origin was of that particular line item on there, you know, helps. Let's move on.
Okay. It was meant
sorry,
for
Lisa.
That's okay.
But I understand what Auditor Dougal is trying to accomplish. He's trying to make it so that you, as board members, get as much information as you can to make your organization better. That's really what it's about.
That's helpful. It's a lot of secrets. Okay. So then, kind of
so
update on the...
The second memo I have in here is just an update regarding our health insurance premium savings. So we were able to take the two-month premium holiday on our self-funded health insurance premiums. So this is how we've decided to use those funds. We purchased the TrackStar software, which is our new employee performance evaluation tool. We did a vaccine incentive. We are doing an employee holiday gift. It's a little Mountain Regional engraved. They have a choice of a couple different items. It's $100 value. Scott's recommending a merit bonus of $1,000 to give back to employees. We are going to fund the additional $250 and $500 for the HSA accounts in 2022. We currently have a safety program, and the admin team has been at a lower level of bonus potential than the operations level. The trust had recommended to us that, you know, people inside the slips and falls and automobile accidents are sometimes just as hazardous as people that are working in the field. So they recommended that we have that at the same level. So in order to raise that bonus up, it's another $1,500 that we're going to put towards that for 2022, and then we wanted to get some additional, kind of along with the employee holiday gifts, just some promo items for customers when we're going out to some different events, and then when we bring on some new hires, have some, like, new hire stuff that we haven't generally had to give to employees. We have some new
welcome
hires
package
to make. Yeah, we don't have any, so we're just trying to get a little more upgrade some of our stuff. So that's $1,200. So that's how we're intending to spend the $55,000 savings.
Sounds really nice.
Yeah, it does sound nice.
Okay, well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That takes us through 7. The 8th item tonight is comments from our general manager, Scott.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. So item A, Karen's just a kind of a reminder here that your board term expires at the end of this year. So we're
hoping. What do I need to do to reapply?
So if you're interested in reapplying, we'd be happy to hear that, and we'll help coordinate that with Annette.
Because Annette will do a new
some of us might use
she
the
does
word
a posting.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd love to be on, so.
Yeah. In December?
Yeah, usually in December, and we'll preemptively coordinate just so things run smooth, but and that'll help us get through the process.
Okay.
She's got to advertise it, and you'll have to fill out some basic application, I would think.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything in the paper or anything yet.
So that's it on that one. Item B is consideration of approval of an annual bonus to district staff. This comes around every year at this time where we ask the board, per personnel policies, there's a board, there's provisions for an annual bonus for district staff members. It's typically given, or is intended to be given to all staff members. It's prorated if they're a part-time employee. Or if they've come on later in the year, but it is a board action to make a decision on whether or not you'd like to move forward with that accommodation. So, in the memo that I believe I prepared, I ran through some of the highlights from this past year. Happy to touch on a couple. Obviously, we had some drought challenges this year that required some additional communication and measures that we haven't done before that I think were very successful. We talked about the growth rate already that we're experiencing. I touch on here the ransomware attack that we were able to work through. Huge thank you to Chris and those that work closely with Chris to get that straightened out and squared away. We adopted our drought response plan. We talked about the fraud reporting policy that was done this year. I've mentioned throughout the year the leak detection efforts that we've done. We've made great improvements, particularly in Silver Springs, to where we're saving about a half an acre foot a day in just Silver Springs and Promontory compared to last year. We've got the community...
Half an acre foot a day.
A day.
Yeah, that's savings. A lot.
We have completion of the improvements for community water that we've been working on for a couple of years. The Spring Creek Spring, a huge thank you to Sam and Brian and the others that were closely involved with that. I mean, we were basically told that there's no way we can get it permitted in the time that we did, and we did. We talked about the additional water rights that we were able to get approved in the last meeting. And then Lisa's been working with Anna on the customer survey and the Everbridge system. So those are some of the things that, you know, that we were able to accomplish this year that I'm proud of, I think the staff's proud of, and we'd appreciate any consideration by the board.
And there seems to be a lot of stability in the leadership, too,
which
I think helps out quite a bit. So confidence and stability.
So with that, we'll just need a motion from the board on whether or not you'd like to extend an annual bonus to the district staff.
And that's in addition to the merit bonus from the...
That's correct, Mike, and I wanted to make that clear in the email that I sent to the board. So,
I was just digging out.
So as part of the health insurance premium savings, we all know it's a competitive labor market right now, and I'm trying to do everything I can to retain staff and acknowledge our team for the work that they have done and continue to do. So the line item in the table on the board here, the merit bonus, the $1,000, that comes out of the meritorious bonus provision in our personnel policies. The annual bonus that we're asking for the board's consideration tonight is in addition to that, and it's a separate section of our personnel policies.
But it totals $2,500 across the board for everybody.
Correct.
You know, I think what we're looking for is it's the motion for the annual bonus.
That's correct.
Yes. The annual bonus. I'd move that the board approve an annual bonus of up to $1,500 per employee.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
That was Karen. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So that was unanimous. This next one.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
You guys have done a great job.
Yeah, I mean, really. It's
been amazing.
Yeah, you have an amazing team, and you guys had to do so much this year, and, you know, I'm glad that...
Deserve it.
Yeah.
And you only included the things in your memo that we might know about.
Yeah. True.
Well, we appreciate all of our employees, too. We just had a little, our safety meeting, and just thank them for, I mean, they have opportunities to go elsewhere and they've chosen to stay with the district, and we really appreciate, you know, that we've been able to keep a cohesive team through all this. So
hopefully everyone will have a Merry Christmas.
I know. I think they will. I think they'll be very appreciative of this for sure.
8C, Mike, is consideration of approval of an annual salary increase for the district general manager.
We're talking about the merit aspect of it.
Correct, yes.
COLA is what the district has. It's just the merit portion of the increase.
We think you've done a really exceptional job this year, and we were torn on this. I was torn on it because I want to recognize that. But you know, as we discussed it, it's administrative controls, and you're in charge, and we want to support you, and if this is what you want, we're behind you, but it wasn't, that didn't work out the way I thought it was going to. But if that's your if that's your decision and what you want, you know, we're here to support you. But
well, I put it in writing, so
yeah. And yeah, we struggled with it a little bit to how to balance that, and so we went with face value, and we were supporting you. And
my position that I tried to explain to Tim on the recently was a couple things. Last year, we were tight on our merit increases to the staff across the district. Okay, and that was recognizing the situation that the community was in, the county was in, the uncertainty of what water usage was going to look like as we went into 2021. And last year, the board still extended the maximum merit increase to me, which was above, I think, anybody else at the staff that they had received. We worked through the renegotiation of my contract this year, which occurred in August, I guess.
But it was effective July 1st, I believe.
I think we got it done. I think it was effective back to August 1st, if I remember. And we got it signed sometime after that.
Right.
But in any event, you know, that was a... I feel as though that was a legitimate increase. I think when my contract or any general manager's contract comes up for renewal, it's time to discuss, you know, adequate pay as we compare against market forces, etc. As I look now, just a few months later, at a 7% COLA, and I look at my leadership team and the people that work in the district, I think that I've been very well taken care of over the last 12 months, and I think that there's others in the district that deserve more than an average bump. And so that was the basis to my request, to have a 0% merit increase.
We're very supportive of your leadership.
Okay. Thanks.
You need a motion.
Okay.
Okay, so I guess we make a motion to do a 0% merit increase so that you will have the option to use that among, you know, as you see fit.
Okay.
And you know, just to acknowledge that you've done an amazing job, and it in no way does that say your merit increase should be zero.
Sounds good. Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah,
that's Joel. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Dave Thomas, any legal updates tonight?
I I talked with Lisa earlier. Let me give you an update on the OSHA vaccine mandate. They have at least a working understanding, because it is somewhat convoluted, and you should understand where the district's at. The first thing you need to know is under the regulations from Congress that formed OSHA, OSHA does not have authority over public employers. The only way they have anything to do with public employers is if the state enters into an agreement with OSHA and OSHA approves a state plan. And under that state plan, OSHA's regulations may be applicable to public employers. There are 26 states that have state plans, that OSHA-approved state plans. Utah is one of them. That's how OSHA regulations are applicable to the district. They're applicable through that state plan that is administered by the Utah Labor Commission, not by OSHA. And that's because, you know, one of the deals with OSHA is they saved on resources by having these agreements with states. OSHA doesn't have an actual presence in the state of Utah. It's the Utah Labor Commission. What happens when you get a new OSHA regulation is once it's published in the Federal Register, the states that have OSHA plans have 15 days to tell OSHA, one, whether they're going to promulgate rules that amend the state plan to be the same as the OSHA regulation, or two, the state can decide that it's going to do a different regulation which serves the same general purpose, or three, they reject the OSHA regulation. If they reject the OSHA regulation, then OSHA has to decide whether they want to terminate the state plan. If they terminate the state plan, then the OSHA regulations apply to private employers, but will not apply to public employers. OSHA has to make a calculation, since they don't have any enforcement resources in Utah. This presents an interesting dilemma with regard to the emergency temporary standard on vaccine mandates that OSHA published in the Federal Register on November the 4th. There have been law cases filed against OSHA in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. One of the 10 states that filed that lawsuit is Utah. So that Fifth Circuit decision applies to Utah as one of the litigants. The Fifth Circuit has stayed the ETS, that's what you call emergency temporary standards. It's an OSHA ETS. They've stayed it in its application. I talked to the Solicitor General of the state of Utah a week ago. The Utah Labor Commission tomorrow, my understanding is they are going to reject the OSHA rule, the OSHA regulation. Don't know what OSHA will do with that. OSHA has stand down enforcement of the ETS earlier today, saying they would abide by the stay issued by the Fifth Circuit. In the end, what that means for Mountain Regional, one, you're not an employer over 100 employees. Two, you are separate from the county, so your numbers are not counted with the counties. So you were a small public employer. As a result of that, one, the ETS would not apply to you, even if it were affected in the state of Utah. Two, it does not look like it's going to be affected in the state of Utah. And even under the worst case scenario, if it were, by virtue of OSHA terminating the state plan, it would still not apply to you because you're a public employer. So I think you're fairly safe that you're not going to have that mandate. In terms of the county is monitoring the Utah Labor Commission and what the Utah Labor Commission decides and continues to decide, because that's basically going to be where we're at. I think to a certain extent, Utah legislature in the last special legislative session may have mooted the issue for the Utah Labor Commission because they provided statutory exemptions to any vaccine mandate, which basically allows anyone to opt out. So that's kind of where it sits.
Is this just for the initial vaccination?
It's for any vaccination mandate. Individuals. There is a separate ETS that applies to healthcare workers and that applies to federal contractors. That is now being litigated in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Dave, can we play this forward a little bit? If the county ends up in a position where a mask mandate is applied to the county.
You mean vaccine mandate?
Excuse me, yes. Vaccination mandate is applied to the county. You said that we're separate from the county, but, I mean, how do you really see that playing out? I mean, is there... Let me ask that a different way. Because we don't meet the mandate requirements, the law, right, then employees of Mountain Regional would have the protection to not, you know, at an individual basis, right?
Yeah, they decide.
There's nothing, you know, it wouldn't be a situation where, the county says, hey, we really want the special service districts to follow these rules too. There's a legal issue, right, for the individuals to be able to say, well, wait a minute, I don't have to because we don't meet the requirements.
We don't roll up under the county.
We're a small
public employer.
One, you're separate from the county. Two, decisions as to vaccine mandates, at least in the state of Utah, have to be made by the public health officer and the county manager. It's not made by the county council.
Okay. I'm not trying to on a vaccine mandate. It's more the understanding of if the county falls under one, what kind of forcing functions or what factors does the district need to consider?
If the public health officer and the county manager issued what's called an order of constraint that required vaccines of certain individuals, whether that be government employees, whatever it is, the state statute allowing exemptions would apply, which means anyone who didn't want a vaccine for, any objection of conscience wouldn't have to do it anyway.
Okay.
So the legislature took the teeth out of that. Consequently, I don't anticipate anything like that coming from, at least from the county. The only thing that could happen is if the Utah Labor Commission decides that they are going to promulgate a rule, and they promulgate OSHA's rule, would still not apply to you since you're under the 100.
Yeah.
if OSHA changed that and said it's all employers, that's one of the problems in the Fifth Circuit case, okay, is that it's not broad enough in coverage. The same risks that associated with an employee of a large firm, the same risks as with an employee of a small firm. So that might be one of the ways OSHA tried to remedy that issue. If that were the case, then and the Utah Labor Commission decided to promulgate that as a rule to change the state plan, yeah, then we'd have to come into compliance with that. And obviously there would be litigation over the fact that the state of Utah has said you can have an exception for any of these things.
Hey Dave, is there any communication that could be given to district employees right now that you could help craft that would be lawful or informative or staying within HIPAA and all this other kind of junk you got to deal with? Is it?
I mean, at this point,
should we get out in front of this to make sure that there's some operator that isn't staying home because they said, hey, I heard that this thing was launched today and they didn't even know what it meant?
I think what you can say right now is that there's a stay on the rule. And
nobody knows what that means.
Yeah, well, that's true. I think what you can say is, as of today, the vaccine mandate is not applicable currently in the state of Utah.
But if you do it like that, you're going to have to issue it every day.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know how to say, because, I mean, although I've been told that the Labor Commission is going to have this same position, and I imagine if they change the position,
they
may all be impeached by the legislature.
Can individuals be in violation of something where they could individually get fined or whatever?
No,
I think that's an important message.
It's the employer that gets fined.
Right.
I mean, so if there was a vaccine mandate through OSHA and the district did not comply, the district would be subject to an OSHA fine.
I think we have a close enough relationship with the group that we can just let them know that we are not under a vaccine mandate at this time and we'll keep you posted.
Can you share with the, how much vaccination incentives have been paid so far?
Sixty percent.
You've paid $6,000 or whatever it is.
60%. 60% of 60/40, which is around. I mean, it's like the normal average that you'd see in the state.
So at least 60%. Could be more, but at least 60.
It's 60 that have had the vaccine. Yep. I hope.
Yes.
There could be more.
It's
than
your
that.
Normal it's national average.
Just didn't ask for the incentive.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know 100% because there was an incentive to go get one that I wouldn't have seen that was paid through Select Health.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but we paid out $3,000.
Yeah. So we only know one subset of that. You know, the barber.
I think everybody recognizes the concern is that in terms of your workforce, losing key personnel because of strongly held beliefs, and that's an issue,
or confusion.
Yeah, but it is an issue in terms of operations, especially of critical government functions, and the county has had the same kind of concerns.
Okay. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah. That's good. Okay. So, last item on our agenda is questions on department updates. And I spoke with Ian, and he didn't really have anything there. Tim, did you have anything?
Just a compliment towards the tech. It looked like, is it Caden?
Yeah.
it looks like the work that they did is going to probably save us time and money in the future.
For sure.
It's a pretty good write-up.
Yeah, he's developing an app that should be should be awesome. He showed it off recently, so we're excited.
Good. Karen, how about did he catch your eye?
Yeah, I just wanted to give a shout-out to Chris. It's a great job getting the community water SCADA system done, and it's always fun to have pictures.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to control a water system too.
Yeah.
This one down the pit. Joel, do you have any questions?
Nope, nothing.
Okay, well, if there's nothing else, we're going to be adjourned at 8:11.